You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It was almost 8 years ago, on December 10, 2008, that Bernie Madoff's sons, Andrew and Mark, told authorities their father had confessed to them that his firm was a massive Ponzi scheme. Why would a successful businessman who seemed to have it all risk everything to acquire more? Eugene Soltis, the Jokerski Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School, set out to answer that question by corresponding with some of the most well-known white-collar criminals. His book, Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White-Collar Criminal, is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased it has brought Eugene Soltis to our show today. Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Didn't your quest to understand the motives of white-collar criminals begin almost a decade ago when you happened upon a TV show?
Yeah, this project began as a personal interest, like many people that followed the news stories, looking at the Wall Street Journal, that every week or two, you'd see another headline of a prominent, once titan of industry, going down, doing something that was totally quite unbelievable.
And there was this television show called Lockup on MSNBC, but they weren't talking to the kinds of criminals you spoke to.
Right. They were speaking to violent offenders. These were people convicted of murder, rape, assault. And I was watching this show thinking about the kinds of executives, kinds of individuals that I followed them as a financial economist, people that were the heads of companies, and wondering if they were in the position of the people on the show, what would they be saying?
Because there's a big difference between their backgrounds. The people on the show came out of environments that were violent and filled with poverty, with drugs. But these people, the ones you're writing about, have lived privileged lives.
Quite the contrary, yeah, to the experience of people that have gangs. I mean, they went to the best schools, they were wealthy, they had great family lives. Their parents brought them up to be successful.
And you write that this research is personal in a way because more than 24 graduates of Harvard Business School, where you teach, have ended up in prison.
They have, and which is a pretty humbling fact because there's not one student on their last day of class at any top business school thinks that they're going to go out, become a successful businessman or woman, and become wealthy, head of an industry, and then find at the end of their career engaging in fraud and going to prison.
Do you address this in your classes?
So this actually is how I end my last class in the programs I teach, is actually reflecting on this, because this is, it's a really humbling question to ask, is how do these people, really, really smart people like my students, find themselves 20 and 30 and 40 years later doing something that they could never imagine doing.
Do they teach ethics in business school?
We do. One of the challenges, though, is you could say one or two classes in ethics. That's 50, 80, 90 hours in a classroom. If you go your first job at your investment bank, your first 3 or 4 days of work, you've spent 40 or 50 hours immersed in that culture, which dominates, you know, already two semesters. So we provide a kind of some ideas to think about some of these challenges. But ultimately, it's renewing oneself and those beliefs over time, which is really challenging to maintain in some of these corporate environments.
And as we learn, the lines often are blurred. We'll get to that in a moment. But let's talk a bit about how your research began. You sent a short questionnaire to penitentiary addresses.
I looked them up. It's actually, we have a very efficient online system where you can look up inmates in federal prisons and a number of state prisons online. And that night, 3 a.m, while I'm still waiting for my regression output, I sent letters. The first couple questions that came to the top of my mind. Thinking about how their compensation might have affected their decision making. What personal pressures they had in their life that might have been affecting their decision making. Did they feel they got a lot of pushback from other people in their firm when they might be doing something that might be a little bit dodgy? And a number of people responded to these questions. And in other people, like the former CEO of Tyco, wrote me a nice note saying, I have plenty of time now. Just come visit me and we can chat.
And he was one of the people you talked to. You also sent Bernie Madoff the questions, Alan Stanford, executives from Enron and Worldcon, some lesser-known figures. How many altogether?
Around 4 dozen. That have been convicted criminally.
So close to 48, obviously.
Yes.
Did everyone answer?
Virtually everyone did. At first, some people respond that they don't know if they want to talk, they're not comfortable. And so one of the things that I needed to do was spend time, in some sense, to help them better understand what my approach was, that I wasn't going to helicopter in and spend one day talking to them and write a piece. The privilege of being an academic is I could spend as much time as I needed. I wasn't a journalist that needed to produce an article at the end of the week. So these people, in some cases, I would spend weeks, months, in some cases, like Bernie Madoff, I've spent years speaking to.
And you quote this from To Kill a Mockingbird: you never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it. And that's what you were doing. You were just talking about other things, not necessarily the crime, to understand who these people were.
That was the most revealing part of the conversations, because everyone's mind, even if they try to tell the truth, which, you know, we could potentially doubt, they're convicted criminals, but people's minds are biased. But what you can start getting a revealing sense of someone is not talk about their case, but talk about other cases. Talk about other things that are going to news, politics. In some cases, I would actually give them my syllabus for my class and actually be talking about the same things I'm talking to my students about, because I want to see how they approach some of these challenges compared to what we're doing in the classroom. And it was those times that I felt I had an opportunity to see the world a little bit differently. That was ultimately the goal of the project.
In your job at Harvard, your expertise is in studying how individuals and organizations confront and overcome challenging situations. Does that mean that you have to have some training in psychology and sociology?
This is where I spent a lot of time, and one of the reasons why this project was not a year or 2 years, but ultimately one that I spent over eight on. Because in many ways, it's trying to understand the psychology, the sociology, criminology. Because one of the parts that makes understanding white collar crime so difficult and fascinating is that it's a question across different fields. It's an interdisciplinary question. And most people don't have the time and resources to be able to think about it like that.
Did you find that some people were relieved to be able to talk about these things in a way that they might not have during criminal proceedings?
I think some people they always enjoyed talking about the successes in their career. And they enjoyed talking about, because I'm a financial economist by training, they enjoyed talking about the technical nitty-gritty. But I think that the challenges are something that no one really enjoyed speaking about. I think trying to provide more complex nuances that they couldn't say potentially when they were on trial or when they were earlier is something that they might have appreciated, but it was still difficult. And I saw that in every single conversation I had.
My guest is Eugene Soltes, S-O-L-T-E-S. His book, Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal. You have given your prologue the title, Managing in the Gray. And one of your arguments concerns how acceptable norms in the business communities differ from those of the broader society. Can you give us some examples?
We saw this viscerally during the Occupy Wall Street issue. I think there's one example that Andy Fastow actually provide that describes in the case of Enron how the norms at Enron differed from outside.
He had been the CEO or CFO?
Chief Financial Officer of Enron, and very much led many of the challenges that Enron faced. And the simple analogy, because we could spend all afternoon talking about the complex financial shenanigans, he said, well, remember, put yourself back in the place of being in high school where a friend, you want to go to a friend's party. And you ask your parents to go, and your parents say, sure thing, you can go under one condition, that you don't drink any alcohol. And you agree with your parents that you won't drink any alcohol, and you happily go off to the party. And when you arrive at the party, a buddy of yours comes over, offers you a beer, and you politely decline in deference to your parents' rules. But then an hour later, another friend comes up to you and says they have something new. And this is a pill. And this pill is a beer pill, and it has all the same intoxicating effects as drinking half dozen beers, except you just swallow it and that's it.
And they won't smell it on your breath.
It won't smell it on your breath, but you're still going to, if you try to drive a car. And you think about it for a second, but then you realize you only told your parents that you wouldn't drink any alcohol. It's okay to take this pill and swallow and eat the intoxicating pill. And so you happily do that, thinking that you're actually quite virtuous because you're technically following the rules. And that's...
He actually worked that out? That's pretty clever.
There's actually a powdered alcohol, so that it's actually true these days. But this very much kind of captures the feeling in many of these instances of white collar crime.
These people you interviews kind of felt that they'd been operating within acceptable norms.
Technical rules. So you look at all the rules. You look at all the rules and you say, well, as long as I follow all the technical rules, Mind you, some of them are actually lobbying to also change them. So you change the rules so it's in your favor, and then you technically follow those, and then you say, well, I didn't do anything wrong because it was technically correct.
And in the big debate over regulations, we might very well see people in the future being able to do things that they weren't able to, that they're not able to do right now. And you note that 100 years ago, much of the conduct of these executives wouldn't have been illegal. And even a half century ago, the public wouldn't have cared much about it. What's changed?
It's a really exotic, the idea that 80 or 90 years ago, a businessman, as they predominantly were, would go to prison for a business crime. It was pretty unheard of.
There was no such thing as insider trading?
Yeah, there wasn't insider trading. There was things around antitrust violation, food and drug adulteration. But the kinds of things that we now routinely say a leading executive should go to prison for, that really didn't happen except in some really egregious cases. One case, actually, it was Attorney General Kennedy and President Kennedy actually wanted to make a big deal of some of this corporate wrongdoing in the 1960s. And so they actually indicted a number of prominent executives from big firms like GE and Westinghouse. A couple of these executives did end up going to prison for short sentences. And then when they got out of prison, the head of Westinghouse issued a press release saying that the executives that went to prison were fine, upstanding men of their community, leaders of the country club. And of course, we're going to hire them back in the exact same position. It was kind of like they took a 3-month break in prison. I mean, today we would find that to be just outrageous. But that was very much the perception at the time, if we go back 50 years ago.
But even more recently, after the 2008 financial crisis, when prosecutors were asked why they weren't pursuing criminal charges for many of the people involved, they said it was really hard to prove it in court, mm-hmm. that they would just build a case and the juries would let these people off. But have things changed? Did the financial crisis change some attitudes? Has the growing income gap played a role in why we even look at these crimes today?
There's a high degree of moral outrage. And we see this most prominently in someone like Elizabeth Warren, who in many ways, when we see her bring an executive in front of the panel and just brutally goes after them, even when it's not clear what the technical regulations, it offends us morally. And we see this with Occupy Wall Street. We see this with Senator Warren's.
And many people see her as a hero. But on this very station, a financial writer called her actions demagoguery. So it depends on which side of the fence you're on and as to whether Elizabeth Warren is doing something good or not.
It is controversial. And I do worry in very much this kind of populist way about whether that can vilify business, because business has an extraordinary ability to actually do good. And I think most executives are well-intentioned. So we need to separate the people who are trying to do well from the ones that either through mistakes or through their deliberate actions are actually doing things that are quite detrimental and harmful.
We're going to take a little break and we'll come back with some examples, some of the people that Eugene Soltis talked to in preparing for this book. He is the Tchaikovsky Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. And his book is Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal. It's published by Public Affairs. Stay with us for more. We are back with Eugene Soltis of the Harvard Business School. His book, Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal, is published by Public Affairs. And you begin your book with the story of Scott London, who in 2013 had much to be proud of. Who was he and what was he doing for a living?
He was a senior partner at KPMG, one of the nationally renowned accounting firms. He led the practice for the Western United States, had over 500 employees under him, and he was making around $1 million a year, a little less than a million, and had a great family life too. Number of kids actually entering the accounting profession. So it seemed like everything was going well, personally and professionally.
And how did he get involved with Brian Shaw?
An old buddy of his, a friend, which over time, in terms of talking about a number of the clients that he had, this is the kind of things that after you've had a stressful day at work, you're at the country club, you're at a bar, and you start describing some of the challenges that you face, where it's a slippery slope, where you start describing some of those stresses in an abstract, broad way that wouldn't neglect client confidences. And then over time, you start giving a little bit more and a little bit more. Brian Shaw's business was in trouble. He had a jewelry business. This was after 2009. And then Scott started to give him a little bit more information, the kind of actionable information that ultimately Shaw was able to trade on. In return, Shaw gave him, it would be a watch, actually two Bruce Springsteen tickets, and then ultimately this envelope of money, which there's this photo that FBI agents took, a telephoto lens at a van, where London was kind of perplexed even why he was getting this envelope of cash. So really, he was giving these, you could say, these tips for, it would be, at best, a couple music tickets and a watch.
And to help out a friend.
Help out a friend.
But he didn't know that the friend was also working with the FBI?
He didn't know his friend was actually... I mean, this is the kind of routine thing that regulars can pick up on with this kind of insider trading. And his friend ended up cooperating with the FBI, wore a wire, and ultimately this is how London was caught.
Well, you wind up with a situation where here's a man who has a 30-year career, nearly seven-figure salary, great family life, and for about $70,000 in cash and some tickets, he winds up committing a crime. But you write that insider trading can be legal at times. When do you determine whether it's legal and when is it illegal?
Yeah, this is the part that's fascinating about insider trading, is that there's lots of versions of legal insider trading. Anytime an executive, director, an employee trades in their firm's shares, they're committing some kind of insider trading that's entirely appropriate as long as it's reported to regulators. But there's also forms of illicit trading, and this is when information is being misappropriated. There's one nice example I like to think of which kind of shows this odd, perplexing distinction. About 2 years ago, the SEC went after a couple analysts working at the bank credit card processor Capital One. And these analysts looked through the millions of credit card records and actually found that by doing a sophisticated tech search, that more often people bought burritos at Chipotle, went to retailers, that the store sales would go up the next month, the next quarter. And so they came up with a sophisticated trading pattern algorithm, which after searching through all the records internally, they started buying options on the firms they thought would go up. Ultimately, they made a couple hundred thousand dollars. This is illicit insider trading, and the SEC caught them for this. Now, what's interesting, though, is that what could have been done alternatively, what would have made this legal, is that Capital One could have sold this data, the records for their clients, to a hedge fund, for, let's say, $1 million. And then a hedge fund trader could have run the same algorithmic search, and then the hedge fund trader could have then placed these trades. That would have been totally legal. So there's a very, very gray line between what makes it legal and illegal, and it's not based upon necessarily the information that's being traded.
And that leads us to Rudy Giuliani. In your second chapter, you write about a very different Rudy Giuliani than we see today. He had a reputation as a crusader against white-collar crime in the 1980s and 90s before he became mayor of New York City. More recently, he has kind of dismissed charges of fuzzy business behavior for Donald Trump.
He was a very, I think, different figurehead in the 1980s. I mean, he was the person that if you were an executive, if you were a banker, You feared Rudy Giuliani because he was aggressive at going after with people. But then beyond that, he was also aggressive in making a stand that we're going to show people that this is not okay. So he would march his officers into the offices of Goldman Sachs, arrest the trader, put handcuffs on them, and walk them out in front of all their stunned colleagues.
Richard Wigton, you write about. Yeah,
this is the perp walk, which is now something that's quite common. All district attorneys we see doing things of this nature. But this was pioneered by Rudy Giuliani. He also used things like the RICO, something that was normally used to prosecute people in the mob. But he creatively, and you could say very aggressively, in a way that some people thought was even overstepping the bounds of being too aggressive, trying to get after people for white-collar crime by using different statutes. And so, yeah, he was as tough as they get at the time he was running.
But it was also, some people thought, was a way of getting a lot of publicity because, as you say, the press was always invited to participate.
Yeah, so I think it's hard, and I think now with the benefit of hindsight, understanding whether if this was a personal view that he had or this is also a very prominent way to gain a lot of national coverage.
Well, talking about national coverage, one of the most talked about sections in your book involves your conversations with Bernie Madoff, and you say Madoff remains dispassionate, even about circumstances that are of the greatest significance. What happened in September 2014 after his son, Andrew, died of cancer, is that when he finally opened up to you?
No. So we had a regular Wednesday evening exchange, 7 p.m. Is what we're doing every day, every week for a couple of years. What our relationship evolved over time, getting to know him more personally.
Did you like him?
He was cordial. I'll say polite. He's smart, brilliant. But simultaneously, there is a part where you develop a relationship with someone just by spending so much time conversing with them. But simultaneously, in the back of my mind, I was always aware of the tremendous harm he's done with people. But this incident when his second son that you mentioned passed away. So this was an incident that really took me by surprise, and that I always had my conversations with the participants in my book well organized. I knew what time they were going to call from their prison. They'd be collect calls. And one afternoon, as actually I was reading the obituary of Bernie Madoff's son recently passing away, I picked up my phone. Phone's rung while I was actually reading his obituary, and I was surprised. It was actually, this call is from a federal prison. Do you accept this call? The normal. And I looked at my schedule. There was no one I was expecting to speak with, but it was Bernie Madoff at the time when I was reading the obituary of his son.
And so you expected him to want to talk about his son's death, but that's not what he was wanted to talk about.
Yeah. Well, briefly, so he asked me to read the obituary to him, and then soon after I finished, I'm in a lack of what to say. I mean, I fortunately have never been in the position of having to convey this kind of difficult news to a father who just heard his son died. So I convey it and ask, is there anything I can do? Is a lack of anything better to say? He says, I'm fine, and then says, well, can we go back and actually talk about Swiss interest rates? And for the next 11 minutes, our calls about Swiss interest rates. And there was something just rather extraordinary being able to, in some sense, move past. I mean, something that's just so extraordinary so quickly, and then move to have this fluent conversation, which he was having a fluent conversation. I think I was still in another place during that conversation.
I'm speaking with Eugene Soltis. His book, Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal, is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I get the feeling from what you're saying about Madoff here is there was a slippery slope. He initially didn't see himself as engaging in criminal activities, and little by little, he found himself into it deeper and deeper until he couldn't get out.
I think it's giving Bernie Madoff too much credit to say he's a villain, but he was not a mastermind of something that would become a 20 maybe plus year Ponzi scheme that would be in the tens of billions of dollars. No one can concoct that from the start, but by a set of being this interesting personality where he's able to be very captivating to people, draw people in because of a couple of regulatory missteps that overlooked some of potential ways he could have been caught, it just continued and continued.
But he also was initially trying to cover some losses. And did he think that the losses were manageable if he just cut a couple of corners?
Everyone thinks initially that the losses are manageable. And in many financial institutions and brokers will have errors. And what you try to do is get them under control very, very quickly. You don't double down and keep going. And what he did was, you could say in the most extreme way, kept double down. He kept it going, kept bringing in money, thinking that eventually, this unrealistic optimism that eventually he'll be able to do some strategy to get him out of this. But even by his own admission, by the late 90s, although it even could have been earlier, he wasn't even trading anymore. So there was no way for him to ever get out of this by that point.
You quote him as saying, it's like a comedy of errors. To cover the losses, I decided to take in money from hedge funds. And in order for me to do that, I had to commit to a long-term strategy that I wouldn't send the money back. I kept taking in more money, figuring that once the market allows me to do the strategy, I'll be able to fix it. And then you say he went past that and he just simply understood that he was running a Ponzi scheme?
He understood that he could never get out of it. I mean, one of the things.
But when you're doing that, if you're a reasonable person, you must also understand that sometime or other, this whole thing could collapse and you could wind up in jail.
So I really did push him a number of times because I wanted to say, what was the end game? How did you see this ending? Because once he stopped trading, there was no way to realistically get out of it. And he didn't respond to that question in the first number of times we talked about. But then once he said, you know what, there was one way I did think I could get out of it. He as one of the leaders in the financial system, he saw what happened after 9/11 when many of the bank vaults were destroyed and the records lost. And he said, you know what, if there was another attack like 9/11, it would be unfortunate that my family would be gone. I would lose people. But simultaneously, the records would be gone and there would actually potentially be no way to put this back together. It's a really eerie way to think of a way to get out of this fraud. But that's, I think, how he saw it. The question I always wondered, though, I try to put myself in his position, is you finish a day of work. It's Friday. You just spent the day. Investors are jumping head over heels to try to give you more money because they all want to get into your fund. Regulators are calling to give you to seek your advice. People are trying to put you as chairman of their commission. And you go home to your wife and two kids, very comfortable in a beautiful penthouse. And after dinner, you go back to your study and you say, you know what? I know I can't get out of this, but I need to stop this. I need to turn myself in. And we all want to think that I think, have the character to say we pick up the phone and call the SEC, call the FBI, call the police. But most of us, I think, would end up saying, I know this is wrong. I know this needs to stop, but I'll do that next week. I just want one more night of going home to my family, of having this comfort, of just living my life. And the trouble is that the next week comes and you say, I'll do that the next week. And then it goes on and on and on until something shuts it down.
So what happened on December 8th, 2008? What led him to finally tell his sons that he had been running a Ponzi scheme?
Eventually, as any Ponzi scheme does, that relies on you need money coming in to cover the flows that are going out. This is 2008. This is when the flows going out of the firm are just simply too large to continue. And so he saw that in some sense, the end was inevitable. He just couldn't bring in the amount of funds. So it was going to end one way or the other.
He doesn't seem to feel much compassion for the people that he swindled. He said that 80% of his clients were basically legitimate people and respected businesses, but also involved in cheating in one form or another. So he was justifying his cheating by saying, well, they are cheating as well.
It was, you could say, to a whole different level. I saw a lot of other people speeding, so I'm going to speed too. Except you could say everyone else was going 5 miles over speed limit, and he went 80.
And he's not alone in terms of not feeling regret for the crimes he committed. You found that most executives convicted of fraud, insider trading, and embezzlement have little remorse for the harm associated with their actions. And are they usually surprised that their crimes have landed them in jail?
It's surprised. Shocked. Actually, I've spoken to a number of prominent defense firms. They have special rooms painted this light blue and designed by psychologists where they actually have to bring their client into the room to convince them that there's actually going to be serious sanctions, that things are going to become difficult for the executive, because no one thinks when they're in these prominent positions that they're the kind of person that could go to prison, that they're the kind of person that a prosecutor would go after. They're the good guy. It's those bad guys that they see in the paper that are different and deserve to go to prison.
More recently, we had the Wells Fargo Bank scandal. So many people were negatively affected. It was only a matter of time before what happened would become known. But I guess because it was done bit by a whole bunch of different people, they thought it could go on for a very long time.
It was a culture. I mean, what's, I think, tragic about the Wells Fargo case is actually Wells Fargo had an effective culture. Everyone was doing exactly what they were incentivized to do. It just turned out that 5,000 people were incentivized to essentially do something that was fraudulent. It was deceitful.
You mentioned Andrew Fastow, the former CFO of Enron. At one point, he says that if he had said time out and advised reporting the true nature of Enron's financials, then they would have just hired someone new. So it was a matter of holding on to his job?
It's a matter of, it's a way of rationalizing or justifying what you're doing, is that if I'm not doing it, someone else is going to do it. And what am I going to do if I leave this environment? These are prestigious jobs. I mean, he was winning CFO of the Year award for doing the same kinds of things that would ultimately land him in prison. It's well paid, prestigious, respected. And it's only when someone eventually points this out, a prosecutor, when you're on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, that you actually realize that that is not what you probably originally were intentioned to do in life.
You also interviewed Stephen Richards, the former global head of sales at Computer Associates, and his crime doesn't seem as heinous as some of the others. And sometimes I wonder why certain people wind up going to jail, while others who seem to have committed some pretty awful fraud, especially in the lead-up to the financial crisis of 2008, are still walking around, in many cases still running their companies.
President Obama expressed this once very well, and actually in defense at a press conference, where he said, in terms of the last financial crisis, there was a lot of unethical behavior, but it wasn't illegal. And that's the kind of stuff that all strikes us as really problematic, and where we actually need to design better regulation, because if we all see someone doing something that's unethical, that actually should be illegal. And that's the job of regulators to create the laws, and then to have aggressive people enforcing those. The problem is that there's a lot of loopholes. A lot of executives look at the world of the, quote, show me where it says I can't. So you have 50,000 rules, and if it's not actually tells you that you can't do that, it's, quote, okay.
Did all of the people you spoke to, or most of them seem to have been men, feel that what they did was very different from what we normally think of as criminal activities, stealing petty cash, shortchanging customers, cheating on taxes?
It feels very different. I spent a lot of time with these executives. I never once worried about anyone coming up and stealing my wallet and taking $50 out of it. Why? It's because that'd be a very physical. They would see me. They would have to touch my physical belongings. But in a number of these instances, in my own retirement account, I've held shares in these firms, and so effectively they've actually ripped me off a lot more than whatever I carry in my wallet. And so the question, you know, I ask is, well, why would they be never willing to ever take money from my wallet, and I don't need to worry about that, but they would be willing to steal a lot more money out of my retirement account? And that's fundamentally what makes white-collar crime different from street offenses. The victims themselves and the harm is very, very distant, psychologically, physically, even temporally.
It's abstract rather than personal.
Exactly. And so at the time you're actually doing these actions, you don't actually, in your gut, feel what you're doing is actually harmful. And so you can actually be a pretty smart, intelligent person doing some pretty nasty things with really terrible consequences without really at the time feeling that you're doing anything that damaging.
Eugene Soltis is the Jakursky Family Associate Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. His research focuses on how individuals and organizations confront and overcome challenging situations. And he's written a book called Why They Do It, Inside the Mind of the White Collar Criminal. It's published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It was a pleasure.